Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us today as we begin the show by talking with you about stress and anxiety. I think we find it in all ages, but according to studies, our younger generations are more apt to suffer from it. We'll talk about that with Dr. Ned Kalin. He's a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He chairs the Department of Psychiatry, and he'll be sharing with us what happens to our health when we have stress and anxiety. What questions do you have about it? I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. Maybe you're feeling stressed. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Ned Kalin, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
You're very welcome. I'm pleased to have the opportunity.
Let's talk about, well, anxiety, stress. I guess they're different things, aren't they?
Well, they are a bit different. They go together frequently, but they're somewhat different. And as you know, Larry, this is a topic that's familiar to all of us because we all experience both stress and anxiety at some point. And, you know, when we think about stress, we basically think about things that are happening to us in our world that in some way are perceived in our minds as being threatening. And when that happens, we have a whole set of reactions in our bodies that is physiological, where our brain first understands that there could be something that's scary or threatening or bad that could happen, and that triggers off then hormones that are released that get us all revved up to protect us from the potential threat. And, you know, if it's a threat that is occurring that's real, like, you know, you're walking down the street and you cross the street and you're looking at your cell phone and a car's coming and you're stressed about that and you jump out of the way, that's a normal response and your body gets revved up and you can feel anxious afterwards. But some people have that kind of alarm reaction without clear triggers. And sometimes we think about that in relation to anxiety problems. Anxiety is chronic worrying and chronic anticipation about bad things happening in our lives. And again, a lot of us have it, and sometimes it's protective, but a lot of us also have it in ways that make us suffer more than others or not enjoy ourselves as much as we could, or sometimes we're even affected from the standpoint of medical symptoms like stomach problems or back aches or headaches or things like that.
No, so those are really the signs of anxiety then.
Right.
What's the connection between health and emotion?
So, you know, I think as we've talked in the past about this, we have a research institute called the Health Emotions Research Institute, which we started a while back that really is dedicated to understanding this linkage between emotions and physical well-being. And we're interested in stress and anxiety and depression and also positive emotions too. But there's no question that our emotions can really very much influence our cardiovascular system, our immune system, our gut. Just about every system in the body is influenced by our emotional responses and by stress and anxiety.
And obviously then that can have short and long-term effects overall.
That's right. That's right.
On your health. Dr. Ned Kalin, our guest today, lots of callers online already with questions for you. You know, I have a daughter, 12 years old, and she gets stressful about and anxious about her studies from time to time. You know, here, I'm telling you right now, she gets pretty much, she's an A student.
Right.
And it's, I have such a hard time to reassure her or get her, you know, off of those feelings. And I'm sure I'm not the only parent with that problem.
No, you're not. And you know, we're particularly interested, actually, in young folks who struggle with anxiety and who are overly stressed, because we think that there's a wonderful opportunity to intervene early and come up with new ideas about how to help children and adolescents. But in relation to your daughter, very, very common, not uncommon in high achievers. Sometimes perfectionistic attitudes are associated with anxiety. And, of course, you know, that worry and anxiety is one of the things that drives us to perform sometimes.
Yeah.
But you know, when you can't stop worrying, or if you're worrying, you know, out of proportion to what's going on, that's when, you know, I think people can help. And it's particularly difficult for parents for a variety of reasons, especially with adolescents, because adolescents are at a phase in their lives where they want to be independent and not always take the advice or listen to parents, as you might know.
Yeah, she's soon to be 13, so.
Yeah, also, you know, parents struggle with the same issues. It's not uncommon that some of these things run in families, so worrying kids frequently have worrying parents.
Yeah.
And while worrying parents want to be helpful, sometimes in ways that they're not aware of, they can actually make it a little bit worse for their kids.
Yeah.
It's complicated, but by and large, most of these problems, if not severe, tend to, you know, either go away or people learn how to sort of deal with them over time and adapt to them.
Yeah. Well, John in Green Bay has been waiting a bit with a question for you, so let's go there. John, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is, I do apologize for maybe the long, like, structure of it, but a few years back, I was living in a very difficult situation with my family, and I was actually diagnosed with PTSD following some of the things that were happening. And at the time, I was having panic attacks, and I have since definitely worked my way from there. I still, you know, I went to therapy. I read self-help books. I did dialectical behavioral therapy and a lot of stuff like that. And, you know, even though, you know, a lot of these events were 3-4 years ago, I still find myself very much struggling with anxiety and stress, and it interferes with my life because it's constantly the sense of, I mean, because I can handle a lot of stimulus at once, but if it gets to be something that's too stressful, I find myself wanting to definitely go into like a sort of like avoidance where, you know, if I'm given one task to do and it's too stressful for me, I find myself doing, you know, everything under the sun except for that task. And I was wondering if your guest today had some advice for me to be able to quit the avoidance.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, John. Dr. Kayla?
Yeah. So, John, you know, it sounds like you've done a lot of really positive things to feel better and to help yourself. And all of the things that you talked about that you've done are things that I would recommend. You know, other possibilities, and I don't know if you've tried this, you know, there are medicines that are very helpful for anxiety. And it has to be the right medicine for the right people. But also, you know, I think one of the, I guess, the best pieces of advice that I could give you, and this is not easy, is to try to not avoid. And that's the very thing that you want to do when you're feeling stressed. But what I tell folks that I work with is that's the very time that you really have to sort of push yourself, either by yourself or with some support from someone that you trust and close to engage in whatever that activity is that you feel like you want to avoid. Because what happens over time with the avoidance is it sort of reinforces that pattern. So I'm not sure if that's helpful, but that's how I would respond to that.
All right. John, thank you. I appreciate your call. Robert in Stevens Point, we go to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Well, actually, he kind of just answered some things, but I just wanted to bring up a point that, you know, I went through a situation where I lost my mom, my dad, my sister, and my dog.
Oh, boy.
All within, like a year and a half.
Oh, I'm sorry. And that sounds horrible.
It is. It's a horrible thing. And you know, the whole thing was is I my parents had, you know, they had a couple different houses. And I have siblings, but they're in different states. So I was closest to my parents. So basically, I was the one elected to kind of clean everything up, and that's what I did. So I kind of went into an autopilot mode. And then I wasn't sleeping. And, you know, I was kind of nervous because I always thought, well, I can always handle things without medication. And then I realized you can't do that your whole life. You have to be brave enough to go in and say, I need help. And I went into the doctor and I said, listen, I'm having issues. I can't sleep because all I do is I think about everything that I have to do. And I think about everything that's going on in my life because of these situations. And basically he gave me a medication and to take, you know, some of the anxiety away. And then he said, I don't think you're a depressed person, but he put me on an antidepressant for a little while. And then he weaned me off of it. But I will tell you that, you know, don't be afraid to ever go out and say, I need help, because I don't think I would have been where I am or even functioning today had I not asked for help, which was something so out of my realm.
Hmm.
But thank you for, you know, expressing that and getting people to really recognize when they have a problem.
Right.
They need to reach out, because reaching out is the best thing you can do sometimes instead of internalizing.
Right. So I'm glad that you're feeling better. I think the point that you bring up is really important to emphasize to everybody, which is that having anxiety or depression is not a weakness at all. We have a real understanding, and I can talk about that later,
mm-hmm.
why some people are more likely to suffer from these problems. People need to go and get some help and not be afraid to do that. Unfortunately, only about 30 or 40% of people who have anxiety problems seek out treatment, and the same for depression. And a lot of it is because of the societal views that we still have about, you know, these types of problems being personal weaknesses, and all you need to do is pull yourself up by your bootstraps and overcome and get on with life. That's not the case. When you have anxiety that is, you know, moderate to severe, or depression that's moderate to severe, these are can be disabling problems that can not only influence your life from the standpoint of work and family, but also your physical health.
Yeah. Robert,
thanks for helping people. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Robert, very much for calling. I want to give Maddie in Oneida a chance to join as well. Maddie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I wondered if the doctor had heard about, I'm sure he probably has, this recent thing that they have detected that there is a brain-gut connection, and that I heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio that there was a experiment where they gave a one group of mice a probiotic, and then the other group of mice didn't get the probiotic. And then they subjected them to stress by making them swim. And the mice that got the probiotic did not give up, but the mice who didn't get the probiotic gave up. And also, there seems to be such a strong connection with too low of a level of vitamin D and citric magnesium. And I wondered, I know that these things have really made a difference in my ability to handle stress, but I wondered if the doctor had heard about these things and what he thought about these things.
Okay, well, that's a good point you raise. A couple points. First of all, the brain is connected to your gut, and so our nerves, you know, when we're stressed and emotional, and especially with negative emotions, our gut can get turned on and activated, and we can have increased acid secretion and all kinds of stomach symptoms. Secondly, our gut, some people think of our gut as the brain outside of our head, because the gut actually has different types of cells that are similar to some of the brain cells. Some of the same types of hormones that are released in the brain are released in the gut. And then finally, this new area of research that you're alluding to, which is looking at the actual living organisms and bacteria that live in our guts, and understanding and beginning to understand that those organisms, we have a symbiotic relationship with them, and that they affect our health. And now there is some evidence that you're talking about in animals anyways, where they actually can affect our behavior. And so the idea of taking probiotics, I think, is becoming much more of a scientifically based kind of concept. The evidence still isn't there in certain ways, but I think there's certainly enough anecdotal evidence, and the risk is very low, that those types of strategies, I think, are really positive. And one of the things that I talk with my patients about is that each of us are very different in the way we respond to stress and anxiety, and it's really important that we each figure out what are the best things for us from the standpoint of getting us to better deal with what we're facing in the world. And that has to do with diet, it has to do with sleep patterns, it has to do with how we think, it has to do with exercise, all these types of things.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Dr. Ned Kalin, faculty member at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, chairs the Department of Psychiatry, visiting with him about stress and anxiety and how to deal with it and what causes it. Hope you'll join in. We have open lines for you at 1-800-SPEAK. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Anxiety disorders are among, I think, the most common mental illnesses in the U.S., affecting somewhere around 40 million adults in the U.S. Who are over 18. It's about 18% of the population, according to the National Institutes of Mental Health. Talking today with Dr. Ned Kalin, who chairs the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about this stress and anxiety. And again, join in. I think our lines are filling up here. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org. You mentioned, Dr. Kalin, some folks are more likely to suffer from these problems than others. Is there a genetic component, or what's really going on?
So there is a genetic component, and there's also an environmental component, like many illnesses that we deal with. And our research actually is very focused on what are the early risk factors for developing anxiety and depression. And actually right now we're doing a study in girls between the ages of 9 and 11 who we think might be at a little bit of a risk to develop anxiety and depression, and we're actually looking at their brains as they develop to try to figure this out. One of the things that we do know is that if you're a young child that is extremely shy and what we call behaviorally inhibited, that is afraid of new situations and worried about strangers and very reticent to talk, and if that's extreme and if that lasts throughout childhood, this is a very good predictor of the likelihood of developing an anxiety problem in adolescence. And so we're really interested in trying to identify children that might be at risk and also studying them and also thinking about how we can intervene. We think that the genetics account for about 30% of the likelihood of developing an anxiety problem. And so that what that means is that if you look at a population of people, and you look at, you know, you can account for anxiety problems based on genetics across that population for about 30% of what you see. But the other part is environmental, and that has to do with early parent-infant interactions. It has to do with exposure to threatening situations. It has to do with exposure to traumatic situations. And it also has to do with a lot of things we don't understand, peer situations, bullying, stressful things like that.
Yeah, all kinds of issues there. How do you work with both parents and children when you're doing treatments?
So it depends on the age of the child for sure, but parents need to be involved in a child's treatment. They certainly need to understand what's causing the problem and also what the treatment approach is. And frequently having the parents actually involved in the sessions is important and useful. And as I mentioned before, sometimes parents don't know exactly what to do, or what they think they're doing doesn't necessarily help. And the other thing that I was commenting on before as well is that frequently kids that are anxious have parents that are anxious. And so sometimes we can help parents overcome their anxiety, which actually helps children settle down a bit and helps parents to be more effective in dealing with their children.
Andrew in Muskego is a therapist. He wondered about why so many scientifically verified therapies aren't being used in the treatment of anxiety. He mentioned CVT as an example, and I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, so the evidence for the treatments that we know about that are the most effective are twofold. One is medications, and there are certain medications that we know about. Some of the newer serotonin type of antidepressants, like Prozac or Zoloft, actually help with anxiety, even though they're called antidepressants. There are some anti-anxiety medicines, like drugs sort of like Valium or Xanax, that can be helpful. And then the talk therapies are also very helpful and evidence-based, and one of those is called cognitive behavioral therapy. Another is called exposure therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy is a way of helping individuals understand that the way that they think about situations sometimes is not realistic and is actually exaggerated from the standpoint of negative types of things. And so an example of that would be when a child is anticipating a test, and she, this might be relevant to your daughter even, and she is, you know, studying, but is worrying that, you know, if she misses two things or screws up a little bit, you know, she's going to do so poorly that she'll never get into college. And that thinking then triggers off a fear response and an anxiety response, which gets her worrying even more and gets her stomach upset. And then that night she can't sleep, and then she doesn't get enough sleep, and so she's grumpy the next day and more prone to anxiety and so on. And so the idea then with cognitive behavioral therapy is to help individuals recognize their distorted or catastrophic thinking and then to learn how to think in a way that is more realistic in relation to the threat that they might be facing. And so that's one. Another is exposure therapy, which is actually people that have phobias and avoidance problems, actually helping them overcome those types of things. Now, the question is, why aren't these therapies used more often? And that's a bit of a complicated answer, but I think there's two reasons. One is that we don't have enough people who are well-trained in these areas to actually deliver the therapies. And the second is that there are lots of other approaches that people use, therapists and counselors and lay folks, that are not evidence-based but actually are helpful. And that's not to diminish those approaches at all, but there are a lot of other approaches as well.
Michael in Madison up next with a question. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, yeah, thanks. The question I had for the doctor is that I struggle with bipolar depression and anxiety, and my dad did as well, so I know there's biological factors. I know that early in my childhood there were factors as well, and now I'm also in grad school getting two master's degrees. So stress is just a part of my life. I'm curious if there's, and I know that a caller talked about this earlier, but one, a difference in terms of the anxiety felt by people with bipolar depression versus regular anxiety. Two, if you know any nutritional variables that can come into that. I know you talked a little bit about the gut earlier, but looking at specific types of food as well that could be useful to eat.
All right.
Thanks.
So that's an important point. Anxiety co-occurs with just about every other psychiatric problem, whether it's depression or bipolar disorder or even schizophrenia. Or you name it, it co-occurs. And it's part of the, when it co-occurs with these other illnesses, it actually makes them harder for people because in addition to having the one illness, they have, they're plagued by anxiety. Is it different than the anxiety that someone with a pure anxiety disorder would have? I would say that it's not different. It's basically the same miserable feeling that gets in the way of being happy and functioning and wants you to sort of crawl into bed or your house and avoid situations in your outside world. So I think it is, it's basically the same kind of feeling. And the second, what was the second thing that you asked? I'm sorry.
Oh, we lost our caller. I'm sorry.
Well,
it slipped my mind as well.
I remember, too. It was about nutrition.
That's right.
And you know, the nutritional side, again, there's a lot we don't know. A lot of people, you know, believe that there are certain herbs that are helpful. The idea of probiotics and so on. I don't think there's great evidence for that, but that doesn't mean that they're not effective for some people. And I think the best advice I can give around this is for each individual to try in their dietary practices to explore things and to see what helps empirically for them.
And I would think, you know, if you've got a well-balanced diet, that can also, I would assume that would also be helpful.
Well, for sure. I mean, good nutrition, healthy eating, and good sleep and good exercise, which, you know, sound like really boring grandmotherly types of things. they're absolutely essential, and they're really important.
Linda in Madison, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was just wondering if you've heard of an enzyme test that can be used to find out which medications, like antidepressants, work best for certain individuals?
Yeah, so there's a new growing field called pharmacogenetics. And the reason it's called that, it's the pharmacology and genetics. And the idea is to look at one's DNA to figure out whether or not we can predict what medicine would be best for you and what your side effects might be. Now, it all sounds great, but we're just, in the infancy of all this. And unfortunately, like many things in medicine and particularly in psychiatry, folks are quick to try to figure out ways to make money off of some of these new ideas. And so there are a number of companies that are actually marketing DNA testing to tell us whether or not you'd be better off on a drug like Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil or Xanax or whatever. I don't actually believe that the evidence is there yet for the clinical use of these tools. There are some people and some doctors that feel strongly that that's the case, but I would argue that the evidence for that is not there at this point. There are a couple situations where that is the case. If you're extremely sensitive to medications, and some people are, then sometimes some of this genetic testing can be useful. Or if you haven't gotten better at all with any medicines, sometimes it can be useful. But even then, a really good doctor who understands medicines and knows how to use them with you, I think can work with you in a way that you don't need to have those genetic tests.
Oh, there we go. Thank you so much, Linda, for calling. I want to give Amy in La Crosse a chance to join us. Amy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I actually was calling because I had heard Dr. Kalin say something about trying to help children with anxiety, and I happen to have one with documented anxiety. And it's been really hard within the school system because she does have this medical diagnosis, but it's like the school doesn't really know how to handle it. And it's been just really hard because my husband and I also don't really know exactly how to help her, because I also am a therapeutic recreation major, and I do a lot of like stress techniques and things like that with her, and that stuff doesn't seem to help. So I'm interested in the child part of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit about her symptoms?
She doesn't sleep well. She's afraid to ask any teacher for help. And she's very quiet. She won't ask for help, like, if there's other kids in the room, because she doesn't want all the kids to look at her. And I feel that when she was a baby, she had anxiety because this is a really horrible. She pulled her fingernails off. And, I mean, I don't know why any baby would do that.
Okay.
And but also anxiety runs on both sides of her families,
yeah.
My husband and I, and it's really bad on my husband's side.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the reason that my research and my passion and interests are with children and understanding early in life how we can help children. You can imagine someone like your daughter who is suffering with this, if this goes on for a long period of time as she grows up, it not only is going to affect, she's going to feel badly, but it's going to affect how she does in school and how she perceives herself, and as she becomes an adolescent, it can get harder and harder. And so we want to help kids as quickly as we can. I would say that the most important thing is a good therapist who has dealt with a child with anxiety or children with anxiety, and also in your daughter's case, probably a low dose of a medication might be really useful. But unfortunately, as you're talking about, many kids go untreated or are not fully well. And in my view, there is no excuse for not getting somebody fully well. That we need to do that. Now, we can't always do that, but the goal should be to have very, very minor symptoms. So those are my suggestions.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck, Amy. Thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate your call. In terms of online information for somebody like Amy, is there help in that way? Just to add to, it sounds like they've done a lot, but...
Well, I think there are two things. One is the National Institute of Mental Health website is a great spot. And another is the American Anxiety Disorder Association is an organization, it's called AADA, that is dedicated to providing information and helping families with these types of problems. And then finally, you know, if folks are interested in research, we have a website called knowyouremotions.com where, as I mentioned earlier, working with 9 to 11-year-old girls. Mostly, we're not treating them, we're studying them. And these would be girls that have symptoms of anxiety that are mild to moderate, but are not currently receiving a medication for treatment.
There we go. Thanks again, Amy. I appreciate it. I want to go to Ann from Milwaukee, wants to know if there's a connection between physical violent dreams and anxiety and depression.
Well, that's a good question. I think that, I don't know that there's a lot of science behind that. But for sure, I think all of us know from our own experiences that when we're stressed and upset, we tend to have dreams, and frequently we tend to have dreams that are scary or nightmares. So I think in some individuals that's the case, but I don't know that there's a lot of science that supports that. For sure, sleep is disrupted in people that suffer from anxiety, and this is a problem especially in children as well when they can't fall asleep or stay asleep at night.
Nathan in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks. Thanks a lot for covering this topic. I think it's really important. I've noticed an increase, especially recently, I think, in the popularity of meditation and mindfulness practices. And I was wondering if your guests had any thoughts on how that compares or if it's similar to things like CBT, or if that field, if that area of it is being researched or studied at all.
It is being studied, and the University of Wisconsin is a place that is leading in that way. My colleague and good friend Richie Davidson is heading an effort in that area. There definitely is evidence that mindfulness-based meditation is helpful for depression, and there have been a number of studies now, and there's actually a self-help book on that that people can use. And it's also helpful for anxiety. We actually, in our Department of Psychiatry, have mindfulness groups for people that struggle with anxiety and depression. And it's another way of learning to better manage our emotions and to manage our thinking and our stress responses. So I would say absolutely yes, that can be an important component.
Oh, thank you, Nathan, for calling. Bob in Ellison Bay, thank you for calling.
Yes, I'd like to ask the doctor about the relationship between emotionally abusive childhood, which I had, and anxiety.
So we know that, first of all, that emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, unfortunately, are incredibly common in our society and still to this day are overlooked because of some of the taboos that we have about it. We also know that abuse, not only in the home, but in the early childhood years and even adolescence, can occur with relatives or other peers and things like that. And there's absolutely no question that emotional abuse or physical abuse contributes to the risk to develop anxiety and depression. That is a well-known, established fact. Now, not everybody that has abuse or an abusive history is going to develop problems. But if you've had that kind of a background, it interacts with the genetics probably in a way that makes it more likely that you would be more sensitive to stress, and when you do get stressed, to be more reactive from the standpoint of anxiety and depressive types of symptoms.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. And on to Joanne in Westfield next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to touch on, I'm so glad about the topic that we have today and actually how you're approaching it. I'm appreciative that you're really talking about, that mind-body connection, because I think that that's overlooked a little too much. I'm in my early 40s and have had anxiety issues my whole entire life, since preschool, kindergarten. Have struggled my whole life. And what I feel like has been an access issue, a barrier to accessing good care, has been a full understanding of the physiological response that we experience. You know, you talk about the cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's good and it's beneficial, but what I feel like has helped me most is really understanding what discomfort I'm experiencing in my body and what tools can I use to address that discomfort. And once I can address the discomfort, then I can settle my body enough to use some of the cognitive behavioral therapy skills. Because if my body is in reactive mode, I'm not thinking right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think even things like occupational therapy or, you know, some of the movement therapies or the yoga or mindfulness that we've been talking about, what worries me is that so frequently providers want to jump right to, you know, some of the deeper end therapies, what I would, you know, talk about like medications or, you know, some of those therapies that we don't know enough about yet. To me, kids, we think about, you know, right away wanting to put people on a pill sometimes instead of thinking about what are some of the environmental things or skills that we can teach the parents, like you're talking about parents' self-regulation, teacher self-regulation, you know, how are we responding in those moments and then, you know, teaching those regulation skills. Because, you know, I think about your comment about the bipolar disorder and anxiety, and to me it all stems from that same place, that dysregulation in the system that happens when we have those stresses and that physiological response that starts to get ingrained in our body.
Okay. Well, let me make a couple comments. First of all, your life course with this, you know, lifetime of anxiety is not uncommon. Secondly, this is why I'm so passionate about understanding more about what's causing early anxiety and how we can treat it, because imagine if we had a treatment that we could have done for you when you were 3 or 4 years old or five that would have reversed or changed the course of your trajectory. And that's my hope and dream, actually, that we can come up with something like that. There's no question that the mind-body connection is key, and lots of us experience worrying, and we also experience physical symptoms, and they interact with each other. When someone that's anxious feels their heart racing, that just turns their brain on more about worrying about what's going on in their bodies and gets them scared, and then they start avoiding, and the more they avoid, the more their heart races, and so on. And so learning how to manage our physical sensations and understand them and in a mindfulness way accept them and work with them can be incredibly powerful for people with anxiety.
Yeah.
And I also agree that there are lots of other things that can be done that the caller mentioned before medications, but that's not to diminish medications either. There are I want to remind people that most of the medicines that we use have relatively minor side effects and are underutilized in general in our population, and in particularly in relation to children. There's been this recent thing about antidepressants perhaps causing an increase in suicidality, and because of that, there has been a decreased prescribing of antidepressants by primary care doctors, which actually has resulted in more problems and more suicides, we believe, now in the young population.
So thank you so much, Joanne, for calling. And Dr. Kalin, thank you so much. Just to conclude, seek help if it's at all possible.
Yes, I would say that and encourage people to get help and to not be shy about that or feel ashamed about it. There's a lot that can be done, and they should strive for really getting someone that can help them get fully well.
Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you can come back and be with us again. I really appreciate it.
Be happy to. Thank you, Larry.
Dr. Ned Kalin, faculty member at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and chair of the Department of Psychiatry, our guest. Coming up next, we're going to switch gears entirely and talk about your vehicle and vehicle maintenance, especially during the summertime heat. That next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.